Golf Weekly
from Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Off the Ball Open in Abu Dhabi this November. Book your place now at offtheball.com/open.
Oh, wow! In your life have you seen anything like that?
I'm a very confident front runner. I've caddied for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it.
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course I would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course I want to play at the weekend.
Now, you're very welcome along. It's Golf Weekly. We're coming at you ahead of the FedEx finale. We have Peter Lawrie in studio. Peter Lawrie, hello.
Hello, Joe.
And Fionn Davenport in Manchester. Hello.
Gentlemen.
Good to have you with us. There is lots going on. We'll get stuck right in. I'm skipping the tweets ever so slightly today because there weren't that many. Weren't that many great ones. One or two nice honeymoon shots. I'll give you that. But nothing that we need to get our teeth into, I would say.
They've forgotten us, Joe.
Well, they'll come back, Peter. They always do. I wonder, is it a symptom of people not that stoked? Nice American word for you there.
Yeah, there you go.
About the PGA Tour finale, the FedEx Series. Are you into it? Are you enjoying it? Are you watching it? We were sort of commenting on this last week. Nobody is massively gripped by the whole thing, were
no,
you?
No, not at all.
Okay. Good. Well, that's the podcast for today.
There you go. We're all done. Thanks very much. It's not doing it for me, no. And then they're all talk about money now and, you know, all those horrible things that they go through of, you know, applying for $15 million and stuff like that. And, you know, it's really rough on them. Golf is struggling at the moment, I would have said.
Mm.
I think the schedule is all, it's not working. You know, three majors month after month, and then literally the tour is finished in August, and it just, what's going on? Like, what's next, you know?
On the whole money aspect, so let's talk FedEx Cup firstly. There are a few other things we want to get into. New slow play rules on the European Tour. We have Phil Mickelson now absolutely ripped. We have interesting comments from Adam Scott on course setups over in the US in particular, and we have Peter's thoughts on the new European Tour schedule. But to start with Eastlake Atlanta, $15 million is the prize money for the winner. That's hiked up $5 million from previous years. McIlroy on this point was talking, and he said, "It's definitely a thought that's come into my head. How can we make ourselves more relatable to the fans? And having $15 million front and centre isn't probably the best way to do it. Who knows what the winner wins at the Masters? I don't know, because that's not what it's about."
That's because he's never won it. Sorry.
Oh, dear. So again, if the FedEx Cup wants to create a legacy that lasts longer, it doesn't need to be about money. It should be about the prestige of winning an event that you'll be remembered for. That's an interesting point. I don't necessarily think they need to get rid of the $15 million dollars, Fionn, because, look, money talks and that's part of it. But in the coverage, McIlroy's point there is that the $15 million is front and centre. And I have found that over the last number of years as well, that so often the talk is, oh, he'll be nervous here, $15 million on the line, or they all want to win this, it's a big paycheck. It is just talked about in monetary terms and other big tournaments are not talked about that way. Like the coverage, I think, does the stench of this tournament no favours.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And I'm obviously, and Rory's touching on the fundamental truth of the issue surrounding this. Now, first of all, it's always about the money. Like, I don't buy anyone who says it's not about the money. And as much as winning the Masters or winning any majors about the prestige of it, these are professional athletes and they're not, you know, they're not involved without the money. The problem is the front and center element, the vulgarity of it. It's almost as though, I can't remember what it was, but in one of the big LPGA events where they had $1 million in a clear strong box helicoptered in and presented, you don't want to see how the sausage is made. You don't want to see the money. But equally, if it wasn't about the money, then they'd all be playing way more European Tour events and regular PGA events wouldn't be tripping over themselves to try and bump up their prizes. And so it is with all professional athletes. I don't put this out just to golfers alone. The issue, as Kevin Van Valkenburg points out in ESPN this week, is that for most fans and for, I'd argue, some players, maybe like Brooks, the championship season begins going up Magnolia Lane and finishes with the claret jug. So how then do you, how do you generate interest in this? Mm. Who cares? So it has to be about the money. So the money is the only thing that's front and center. And this is the dilemma that golf has. And as much as they say, oh, it's about, they want it. And obviously, maybe in 15 years' time, the FedEx Cup will be a very prestigious thing. But it isn't right now. It's just about the money. The only credence it has is because there's such a huge pot of money attached to it. And I know we had a version of this conversation last year. We had a version of this conversation the year before. Mm. And as much as fiddling around with the event and the staggered scoring and all the rest of it, the problem still remains. Who cares about winning at Medina? Who actually cares about winning this week if you take the money out of it?
Mm. Who won the FedEx last year, Peter?
Pass.
Justin Rose.
Justin Rose. Well done.
Who won it the year before?
The only one I really remember is Bill Haas winning.
Same. McIlroy obviously won it in 2016 when he came back from the dead brilliantly and won in the playoff. That was cool. That was great. Bill Haas is the moment. That's the one.
Yeah. That's the one.
Yeah.
It's a difficult dilemma for golf. Like, ultimately, it's all about the four majors, and that's not going to change. But they have to drive interest elsewhere. So they've created what is meant to be a season-long test, the best player across the season. And yet that is undermined by the fact that a good run in these last three or four tournaments means you just win this supposedly season-long thing. Right from the off, this notion that it's a finale to a test across the season is undermined by the fact that if you just get hot for these two or three weeks, you win the whole thing. What are you left with? Only money. Like, how do you drum up prestige? Mm. I don't have a great idea what the solution is, to be fair to them. Like, they can't just wrap up the season after the Open now and say, well, look, let's be honest, it's a bit rubbish after this. They have to try.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just don't know how they genuinely capture the imagination.
I think it's virtually impossible, to be honest with you. Either that or spread out the majors a little bit further and play these things in the middle of them. But to have two major winners not playing in this, the final end of the season, you know, is, doesn't really work, does it? You know, the criteria for a major champion should be higher than, you know, what you've won the previous week. You know, the way the points double up or whatever else it is.
Yeah. Like last year, we got a great finale courtesy of Tiger. You know, it was this amazing moment. And Bill Haas is a great moment. Rory winning that time was great. I don't think the Sunday is the worst night of the year.
It never is,
yeah.
You know, especially if somebody is there to win it. Mm. Last Sunday night wasn't spectacular.
But I find it's like reality TV or something. I'm kind of invested for that last hour or two and into it. And then the moment when it's over and all that's left is you win $15 million, instantly it's just cold. It's like, oh, well, that's completely irrelevant to me.
Yeah, you know? Especially when you're trying to pay your mortgage or something like that. It's a bit like the football players earning, you know, a couple of hundred grand a week to play football.
Yeah.
Really, it's got to the stage where really we just want to see the football on the field rather than how much they're actually earning.
To be fair to McIlroy, he made an interesting point on that. And he said, well, money is up front and centre in every professional sport. Like he's seen, you know, basketball players get $150 million over 4 years. That's all we get on ESPN SportsCenter was what he was saying. At least the winner of this has to go out and earn it. There was a certain point in that. But like, I don't know, they're not sitting around at the NBA final saying, oh, well, look, if the Bulls win here, they'll all get $10 million each. It's not the thing. And this finale is undermined by the fact that they're just trying to come up with more and more outrageous sums of money.
It does, but if you look at, if you go back on the inception of the FedEx Cup, the idea of getting money off the internet or how much each tournament is worth, changed. Now it went to points, and I used to preach this on the European Tour as well. We need to get away from, you know, splashing out how much Thomas Bjorn won or how much Rory McIlroy won in, on a weekly basis. It should be down to a point system.
And each, because you felt it was vulgar.
I felt that each tournament was always different, and therefore they should be changed a little bit in relation to the point structure of it, rather than one tournament might have 5 million and the other tournament might have a million. But is that five times better than that other tournament? And that's why I thought getting a point structure was much a fairer way to do it. But it also got money off the screen. And I think that's what they did initially, and they worked their way now. But now, all of a sudden, for one tournament, they're splashing it in everybody's face of, you know, the winner gets 15 million.
It's I think Peter makes a very good point. I think, like, ultimately, it is about money. You just don't want to see, like, in every sport, the agent negotiates the best possible fee for his client. And they, I'd imagine that if you got wind of those negotiations, we would look at footballers or other professional athletes in an entirely different light. Or maybe not an entirely different light, but it certainly would cast a pall over the way we view the feet of our heroes when you see kind of the dirty dealings that goes on to try and negotiate the highest possible fee for your client. So it is in professional golf. So when, like, of course these guys do their schedule to suit, you know, they're not in the business of going, well, there's only like, you know, 300 grand as an overall pot in this one. I'll play this one. They're going for the ones with the biggest pots because they're in the business of earning as much as they can. But they're also in the business of winning. And when it's just, I mean, I'm repeating myself, but when it's just about this, when the cash is the only thing that's in play, it leaves the rest of us who can't even fathom what it must be like to earn 50 million quid. It leaves us cold. It's not an impressive thing. It's the opposite of impressive. It becomes kind of, as we've said, it becomes vulgar and off-putting. I think off-putting is the term.
No, fair enough. And doesn't that get to the core of the problem then? So say privately they all agree that, and then they say, well, we need to pitch this then as the best player across the year, the most consistent player. That is undermined by the amount of points which are awarded towards the end of the playoffs. It's not the best player across the year. It's the player who gets really hot across two, three weeks here who wins. So they're kind of left between a rock and a hard place. Like, if they truly commit to, well, this is going to the most consistent player across the year, then more often than not, I think 8 years out of 10, you'll have the winner decided a tournament or two before the finale. That person should be uncatchable because they performed so well in March. And unfortunately for everybody, that happened in March. And now the finale is pointless. They can't have that either. I genuinely think they're screwed here. You know, I don't know what else they can do. Maybe just make it $100 million. That might actually be kind of cool.
Well, what about something like a season, as Peter pointed out? I mean, I think there's real value in this. It's like a season where you have tallied points for wins, places, you have staggered extra points for winning in majors. You make the majors worth, you know, five times more than a regular event or whatever the metric might be. And then at the end of the season, you have a set of playoffs or, well, see, they need something to kind of keep viewers. You need drama.
What if in a dream season, somebody wins three majors, for instance, and then is like, you know, I'm so tired, I'm going to skip the playoffs because I've already won them.
Yeah, he's the player of the season. But Justin Thomas, who starts with the advantage, got hot. He's had an injury-plagued season by his very high standards in the last few years. This has not been a good year for him. But look, he goes in, he got hot, and he's going into the final event with a two-shot lead over Patrick Cantlay.
Yeah,
and
so they can't, even if he wins this week now, they can't call him the player of the season.
Well, Brooks Koepka is the player of the season.
Yeah, I get you, or whoever, you know, yeah, Brooks, I guess. So that's how the thing is fatally undermined. That's their dilemma. Any thoughts at Golf Weekly OTB? Maybe we're missing some obvious solution, but I have a certain sympathy with them. By the way, on the staggered start, you might give us your thoughts on this, Peter. Now, Fiona and I play every week, in effect, with the handicap system, so this is perfectly normal to us. You know, I don't feel weird about having two shots over the guy next to me because he's better than me. Screw him. I want three shots. Justin Thomas goes in 10 under. Patrick Cantlay, two shots back, 8 under. We then have Brooks on 7 under. We have Patrick Reed, 6 under. McIlroy is on 5 under. And then the way they do it for the rest of them, they have five guys on 4 under, including John Rahm. The next five are on 3 under. The next five are on 2 under, all the way down to the bottom five guys who are level par, 10 shots off Justin Thomas. And that is how it lays out. What do you think?
It's the only way they can do it, to create a bit of drama and to give Justin Thomas the kudos of where he is in the order of merit or where he is in the rankings.
Did the point system previously not do all that?
To the finale, possibly not.
Make it more accessible for fans, is what they're saying.
Right. And when they worked it back, I was reading something there on the Golf Channel, when they worked it back, and they didn't have this point system, one or two of the players who would have won using this point system didn't win.
Okay.
Tiger was one of them, and they, I think Jordan Spieth was another.
Okay.
Justin Thomas was the other.
Was he?
Yeah.
So it's not a direct correlation?
No.
Okay.
I mean, to your point, Joe, I mean, I appreciate the parallel with the handicap system, but there is one fatal flaw in that argument, and that is that Patrick Cantlay is not two shots worse than Justin Thomas or Brooks Koepka's three shots worse. So it create, and I think it's an interesting experiment, and I think nobody really knows. So everyone's going to play different kinds of golf. So is Rory going to come out attacking? Is Koepka coming out attacking? And more to the point, is Justin Thomas going to sleep on a lead for five nights? Like, is he going to play conservatively because he's already got this two-shot lead? Each of these golfers who is, they're all equal. They're all equal as good as each other. Certainly the top five guys are. They're going to be playing markedly different tournaments because of the staggered. And that could be very exciting.
Yeah, no,
it could be very artificial.
I don't think it'll change much because the point, it's basically just a simplified version of the point system, which has been there for the last 10 years. So the last 10 years, it would tell you what someone needs to do, needs to finish, you know, tied third. But in effect, that was just saying he's two or three shots off. I really don't see it as any different. I just think, people are saying things, well, look, you know, isn't that, it's going to be weird for Patrick Reed and McIlroy on 6-under and 5-under, four or five shots back. If they still had the point system, they'd be in the same position that they need to play catch-up. They need to play aggressive on Justin Thomas. I think it's just there to make it more accessible.
It's there to make the galleries know exactly what's going on.
It's simpler,
you know.
Yeah, it's like, look, we've had this point system, and now we're shaking it off. I don't think it's the worst. What's always interesting about these things is someone like, you know, when you're in a tournament, and Peter, you'd know, if you're playing well, then when you have a 2-3 shot lead on a Sunday and you're playing well, you have that 2-3 shot lead because you've played well. Whereas week to week things change, and like the leader here might be feeling terrible, and it's like, how can I hang on? That can be kind of a compelling. Yeah.
You look at the European Tour and their race to Dubai, and you go to the, you know, the finale event in Dubai, and the leaders go out late on the first morning.
Yeah.
While if you've just made it in, you go out first.
That's what's going to happen here.
And going out first is very difficult because it's nearly a two shot advantage to go out in the afternoon in Dubai. Because of the heat,
right.
Everything warms up. You're hitting the ball much further and stuff like that. So it kind of works in the same way here, but they're just adding on shots. To be honest with you, I would much prefer to see everybody starting off at an even keel and winner take all.
Okay.
You know, you come into the last tournament, you've qualified for the last tournament, and away you go. You know.
What would your take? McIlroy is an interesting halfway point. He's on 5-under.
Yeah.
To Justin Thomas's 10-under. How would that change your tactics, or would you just have to almost ignore the leaderboard starting off?
I think he'd ignore the leaderboard starting, because he's so used to starting off on a Thursday at, you know, level par. You birdie the first, you get to 1-under. He's not going to be thinking, oh, I birdie the first to get to 6-under.
He is starting with a deficit. He's like, I'm 5 shots back.
Yeah, I don't think he'd be thinking about that at all.
Really?
I think the first time he'll probably look at the leaderboard is Saturday. And see, you know, what do I have to do to get up there? He'll just be playing it as a game of, okay, 20-under is going to win, and how do I get to 20-under? Never mind where Justin Thomas is.
The guys, though, realistically, I would think on, say, 2-under, 3-under, 7-8 shots off Justin Thomas, they have to come out all guns blazing, don't they?
They do and they don't. It all depends how Justin Thomas or Xander Schauffele play, you know. So it's a case of just get out there, play your own, and wait till Saturday, you know, even Friday night to see, you know, where we're going and what's the, you know, the leading score going to be. How many times has a guy just made the cut and, you know, nearly won the tournament?
Rory.
You know, it's happened so many times.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's in his normal place.
Okay, well, we'll see how it all plays out. That's going to be Sunday. It's worth remarking, Fionn, that Tiger Woods' season is over now. This time a year ago, he was winning the Tour Championship, which pointed to a promising 2019, and so it proved.
Yeah.
We don't really have much to get excited about from a Tiger point of view for 2020. This looks like the wind down we all sort of feared. Like this time last year, we were saying, oh my God, this guy is poised to do something at the Masters, and so it proved. But
What a difference 12 months make. Yeah. I mean, and again, and I was reading yesterday that even within the not quite the very inner circle, but certainly in people who would know the Tiger Woods better than we fans, is that even they don't know what's quite going on.
Yeah.
They're very shtum about the nature of his injury or the nature of the toll that this last 12 months took on his body. He looked wrecked, frankly, for the last 6-7 months. And one of the things that it made me remember is, do you remember him at the Ryder Cup?
Yeah.
I mean, he looked old.
Correct. He was just like 4 or 5 days. He'd flown over from Atlanta.
Yeah, no.
But that was a more kind of less worrying tiredness, I suppose.
Sure. No. But I mean, is that what it did is that, like, at the time you're thinking, yeah, he's just wrecked. I mean, he's just had a pretty intense time. And as much as, like, yes, he's shown up at tournaments more refreshed looking, his body certainly hasn't. It just didn't look anything like, or it didn't move anything like it did at this time last year at Eastlake, and certainly not in April. And so, I'm loath to say, oh, we have literally no idea what 2020 holds. So are we back in that holding pattern of, say, 2-3 years ago where you're like, well, I don't know, Tiger Woods, who knows? Mm. And I have to say, that is dispiriting because, you know, it's the hope that kills you. And at the early season augured that, oh, my God, are we going to get at least 3-4 years of Tiger Woods, maybe not at his absolute best, but certainly at his competitive best, and that he's going to challenge again for more majors. And he might well do. He may absolutely do that again. But he's given no glimpse in the last 3-4 months that's a probability or anything, you know. I don't know. Go on, Peter.
If you watch him arriving at a golf tournament, you'd nearly say, like, this guy has no chance of playing.
Did you see the one in the car park the other week?
Yeah, the way he walks in and you feel like, you know, he's 70 years old. Mm. And he certainly looks it. And you think to yourself, and you don't want to say it because you're only going to, you know, tee yourself up for all the criticism out there. You're going to say, we're never going to see Tiger Woods back again. And I think we've all said it. I certainly did, you know, and that's why the Masters was such a surprise.
Yeah.
That I would have said Tiger Woods is finished. He's gone. He's done. And then he miraculously comes out of, you know, like a phoenix rising from the ashes to say that he can actually play golf again. But he looks absolutely worn out. And he looks like a guy who's recovering from, you know, well, he has had surgery, but, you know, straight away from surgery. His movements are slow, laboured.
It is like he's gone back to square one somehow.
Yeah. So
we all thought, Tour Championship win last year, and then the Masters. Okay, we're going to get a good run here. But it inexplicably, like, for a while there was the line from his camp, the Masters took a lot out of him. And you sort of said, okay, fair enough. You know, I guess maybe it probably did. But
that's 2 months or 3 months, but it doesn't, it's not the...
That was April now, and where are we coming up on September? It's
that
doesn't hold. Like, there's something else going on here. There's something more serious going on here, you would have to think. I don't know. So that's the end of the season. I mean, it goes down as good a season as any in his career. It's been amazing, but the promise of 2020 is not there.
No. I mean, it also, again, and at the risk of being a broken record, it also augurs poorly for golf in general because, you know, try though they might, and there are, you know, golf fans have found their new heroes, and there are lots of young players, relatively speaking, who excite. But, like, in the wider community, nobody cares. Nobody cares. Tiger Woods is the only one that... The dial only moves when Tiger Woods shows up. I mean, and again, and it's worth reiterating, as excited as we all were to watch Shane Lowry win the Open Championship, and the fact that the Open got the second biggest attendance numbers in history on TV, it didn't move the dial at all. In fact, it was markedly down on previous years because Tiger Woods missed the cut. And so, again, the perennial problem is that, as Connor sketches, as funny as it's like, maybe his back hurts because he's been carrying the tour for the last 20 years.
Mm.
carrying golf, never mind the tour.
Yeah.
Everybody feels it.
Medina. The reason Justin Rose is 10 under par going into Atlanta is that he was sensational at...
Justin Thomas.
What did I say?
Justin Rose.
Well, no.
He was sensational at Medina, but a good few years ago.
Yeah. Medina was taken apart, you know. We had heard, we kind of previewed this and said, well, this was a bomber's paradise and we'd see how they go. Hideki Matsuyama set a new course record with a 63 on the Friday, and then on the Saturday, Justin Thomas smashed that mark by 2 shots with a third round 61. The more interesting statistic is on this supposedly hard golf course, 64 of the 69 players in the field were under par.
Mm.
That's the more interesting point. Adam Scott said the following, they, as in tour officials, they haven't figured out yet that long means nothing to us. You can't build it long enough. I'm not surprised to see these low scores at a place like Medina. If the golf course is soft, we're going to tear it apart. And he went on to say, I'm not challenging PGA Tour officials to build longer golf courses. I'm challenging them to build smarter golf courses. If you require us to shape tee shots to get it in play, then we're going to struggle. Now we just play it straight. Everything is straight. He said, while there is an option to go over trees and over bunkers, it's just relentless. The driver, he said, and this upset me, I won't lie. I didn't like this next line, but it'll continue. The driver is the most forgiving club in the bag now. It's just swing as hard as you can and get it down there far. I don't find that, Peter, but anyway. It's not a skillful part of the game anymore, he said, driving. And that's really unfair for some guys who are great drivers of the golf ball. I don't think their talents are showing up as much as they should. And Woods made the point as well. When I first came out on tour, so he joined in. When I first came out on tour, there was a lot of one irons, stuff just off the tees, get it in play type golf. Now you just pull out the driver, bomb it down there, and you're looking for 3 to 4 good weeks a year. That is how you play modern golf. It's not consistency. It's not about making a bunch of cuts. It's about having 3 to 4 good weeks a year. That's the difference. And the guys understand that. Today's equipment, you can maximise a driver and just absolutely bomb it. And some of the guys sacrifice stuff around the greens or short irons for the driver. The driver is the most important club in the bag today just because of the way the game's played. Interesting. Not surprising much of it, but interesting.
Eduardo Molinari, if you remember this, came out with a stat. Remember he went through all the stats maybe 2 years ago or 3 years ago and he spoke, he was trying to break the routine that your short game mattered. And
drive for show, put for dough.
Exactly. And he came back with all these stats to stating the fact that the driver was, you know, you had to get it in play, you had to hit it long, driver was the most important club. And he was right. And technology has really developed the driver to an extent where they're going to have to do something. They really will.
With the ball or that the driver is too forgiving?
With both.
Okay.
They're going to have to do something with both. Technology of the drivers, of how their face is made up, and also with the golf ball. Like, look at Rory McIlroy. I don't know whether you watched this or not. Was it on the 8th or 9th hole that he took it over a corner? I just saw a clip of it, and literally he was hitting it straight over the gallery to go over a corner. Mm. And you know, the cameraman had no idea where it was. And then all of a sudden the ball appears out in the fairway, and you know, that was the way Rory was playing the hole. And he was taking a lump off the corner of the dogleg.
Yeah, not the way the course was designed.
Exactly.
No.
And this all
drivable par fours?
Do
you remember Medina having a drivable par four 10 years ago?
No. No.
No.
Not even close to it. And even in the Ryder Cup, we didn't see that. You know, a drivable par four.
Let's follow that through for a second, because everybody agrees, and that Adam Scott's point is well made. Okay, there are various solutions. One is they've got to change the golf courses and change the setups. And I don't know how you do that in certain courses. I remember at the Masters, there was a joke, would they put up netting on the par five to stop Bubba going around the corner, which wouldn't be the most aesthetic thing in the world.
Yeah.
But anyway, if they're not going to change the setups, then say they change the ball and... Changing the driver is a very interesting point. You know, make it more difficult, less forgiving. Woods and Scott there are saying this is the most forgiving club in the bag. That is not fair on rank bad amateurs like me. So then we're into bifurcation, as in different equipment for the pros and different equipment for the amateurs. Are you in favour of that? Is that where you want to go with the game? Because one of the great things about it now is that I hit a Pro V1 or I hit my TaylorMade ball and it's the same ball the pros are playing with. And I take out my driver and it's the same the pros are playing with. And there is...
But it's not the same.
Well, give or take, no?
No.
The balls are the same.
The ball is the same, but the driver's not the same. The shaft is not the same.
So what's the difference?
The shaft is better. The club face is probably a little bit thinner than than what you would get, you know, as a regular amateur.
Okay. But I'm sure I could get a pro type driver if I wanted it. No,
there's very few out there that you can get, to be honest with you. You know,
is that because it's more forgiving for me?
It's more forgiving for you.
Okay, well, that's fair enough then. But ostensibly, there's no rule.
My driver no hit it a little bit further than your driver.
Fair enough. But there's no different rules governing your club and my club.
No, but there should be.
Okay.
We need to get golf back to being able to watch TV and watch the guys play a golf course of, you know, 7,000 yards and not absolutely destroy it.
Mm.
So we need to rein back in the ball and rein back in the clubs.
Mm.
And there's a set of clubs for professionals and a set of clubs for amateurs.
How do you feel about that, Fionn?
Yeah, I mean, but here's one. I'm going back to Adam Scott's point. So they're making these super long courses. Jack Nicklaus 15 years ago talked about bringing the ball back, you know, reining back the distance of the ball. What about this? Okay, so here's the thing. The fairways are your average width up to 290. From 290 to 350, they get super narrow. So it disincentivizes you to take driver that length. But if you are good enough to go and hit that 15-yard wide patch, well, you know, more power to you.
Mm. But you know, so take that point for a sec. I saw somebody, there was a tweet, I shot at Thomas, at Medina in what looked like the stickiest, most awful rough you can imagine, and he just blasted it out of there. Brooks Koepka in rough, doesn't really matter, just muscles that out of there, no problem.
You can grow rough higher.
Well, to a point, I don't know. And the PGA Tour also like getting the fans close and it's all trampled down on and... Genuinely, I think, and Branel Chamley's been good on this, being in rough 100 yards further up the course is the choice they will take every time. No question, every time, Fionn. I don't think that'll stop them.
It echoes similar to the money debate. The other truth, they want low scores. Like, the PGA wants low scores. They don't want scores at level par.
Yeah.
It's like, in their mind, it doesn't make golf as exciting if a guy's like, oh my God, he's winning, or he's top five at plus one.
Yeah.
They want those. Now, it's ridiculous if there's the first 15 guys are all like at double figures below par. You know, then it's, you know, no disrespect, but it's like, I was watching the Czech Masters and I was looking at the scores. I was just like, geez, how many players are 20 under here?
Mm.
But I mean, you can grow the rough. US Opens, how many you can have US Open style courses.
Yeah.
And it'll make golf really hard.
But there again though, we go back to the pace of play issue then. And if we have that kind of setup, the pace of play almost stops. Because guys are hitting it in the rough, then they have to go find it and then they have to try and hit it out of that stuff. You know, your pace of play goes back to being, you know, exceptionally slow or doesn't improve of where we are at the moment.
Mm. But okay, that's a good point. But let me ask, I mean, surely to God, it is not beyond the skills of golf, I mean, professionals in the game of golf as opposed to the players themselves, to disincentivize a player from going off the fairway. To the point where it's really penal, where it's like, you go into that fairway, it's going to cost you two shots minimum. Like, surely, I mean, they can do it. So, I'm not suggesting this is the only solution, but that surely has to be part of the conversation.
It does, I'd agree with you there, but I think the simpler one is to rein back in the ball and have a golf ball that is whatever compression you want to go with, that goes 20 yards less, you know, or 40 yards less, or whatever it may be. But the advantage now of being strong and swinging it really fast, the idea of, I would love to see Greg Norman, who was probably the best driver of the ball that played golf in the 80s, play now.
But that's Scott's point, is that Norman's advantage in the 80s wouldn't count for very much today.
No, it wouldn't count at all.
Because the lesser drivers would be able to hit it vaguely similar to Norman.
Yeah.
That's a very interesting point. I'd be really interested to go back to less forgiving drivers and see who's who. Like, so it's hard to know who the best, really most skillful drivers are today.
Yeah. I imagine the guys turning up on a weekly basis and they had to use a certain set of golf clubs and a certain golf ball. We need to try 1 week like that. Like, the European Tour are great at trying things. Like, they've tried the Shot Clock Masters, they've tried the match play, they've tried this. Let's try an event where, you know, everybody has to use the same ball and everybody has to use the same set of golf clubs.
Because there is, they're reluctant. So here's my kind of feeling watching golf now, and I'd be interested to know what you think is the most kind of egregious or worst part of watching the modern game. So, like, when you're there as a spectator, it's pretty cool to see them hit the ball a gazillion miles. But on TV, it makes no odds to me. I can't on TV, and nobody on TV can tell the difference between a 320-yard drive and a 270-yard drive, because they hit it, and then the camera cuts to the fairway, and you wait for the ball to drop.
Yeah.
So actually, I lose nothing if they're hitting a 270 versus 300. Yeah. It's just as thrilling to me. What bugs me about the modern game now is the Brooks Koepka style. And I love Brooks. I love him. But just on too many holes.
He's taken, by the way. Did you see that picture recently?
We'll come to that.
Wow.
What a body. To be honest, I was disappointed.
Okay.
I thought he was going to be more ripped. But so
wasn't looking at him.
Right. What bugs me now is the type of golf whereby Brooks, okay, it's these guys, they don't rotate the club. It's just bombing a million miles, and then they just hit these wedges in, these chicken arm wedges. Mm-hmm. I'm so bored of watching this type of golf. And it feels like it's on 70 to 80% of par fours, that they bomb it, grand. I guess that's a pretty cool moment. Sometimes it's fun to watch them cut the corner and you're like, ooh, you shouldn't be doing that. It's kind of cool. But it's these like 160 and in kind of chicken arm, open stance, just push it in, shots into the greens that are just boring the hell out of me.
Yeah, and no skill.
Michael Hoey had a brilliant tweet the other day. You should have a look at it, where he was at a par three on the European Tour. And he just took a picture of the tee box and the divots on the par three. And he was saying, look at this. Every single divot's over to the right-hand side. And they're all, like, he was saying, everybody's hitting a fade in now. Everything's just this.
He was saying
there's no rotation through the ball anymore. It's just a hold-off shot, exactly.
Yeah.
And he was saying, everybody's hitting the same shot on tour now. And I presume if you change the equipment, that we can get a little bit away from that and have a bit more variety, or would that be there to stay regardless?
No, you'd have variety.
You sure?
Absolutely. You'd have to.
Okay. I wasn't so sure.
Interestingly enough, although we criticise Rory McIlroy for, you know, certain weaknesses in his game, whether it's his putting or his mental strength under severe pressure, if you were to adjust drivers to encourage the truly talented drivers and discourage the guys who use forgiving equipment to bomb.
Yeah.
I would make a case that say that Rory McIlroy, this would advantage him enormously, because he is a genuinely talented golfer. He can move the ball both ways. He isn't relying on the kind of turn and burn. This is a guy who can really control his golf swing through the ball. And so in a sense, you would have it wouldn't equalize the playing field as it does now. So, for example, Rory's advantage is negated in the face of 10 other guys who can hit it just as long as him. That if you were to use less forgiving drivers, that all of a sudden Rory's real talent would shine.
Peter, can I ask you, is it the equipment that has brought in this Brooks Koepka style iron play and made it in vogue, or would this, you know, if say the equipment hadn't changed, would this have just happened anyway? Have these guys just found a more consistent way to play the game that actually it makes a ton more sense to keep the club face straight for as long as possible, and the equipment has played no part in that? They would have arrived at that conclusion anyway.
I think going back to, you know, many, many years, you go back to Tiger Woods changing the game, really. And he changed it in relation to his body. Nobody was going to the gym as much as he was, and building himself up and building his strength up to be able to play the game like he did. And the likes of way of Brooks comes in and Rory comes in now, you know, holding it off requires an awful lot of strength and speed. And these guys then have developed their body skills and their athleticism. Rather than the actual equipment. And equipment then has just worked in with it.
And if you brought the equipment back to, I don't know, 80s, 90s, whatever you're talking about, for instance, and put it in the arms of a Brooks Koepka strong player, would Brooks still be able to play his game?
Oh, I think so, yeah.
Okay, so then it makes no odds.
It does make an odds, though, because, look, they're not building land anymore. We've only got a finite amount of land.
Yeah.
And having golf courses being exceptionally long, it takes a long time to play them. And we're going to move on to pace of play, issues and stuff like that. So it all brings it back together. If you play a shorter golf course, it takes less time.
Yeah.
You know, but if you're only able to hit it, even Brooks Koepka is only able to hit it 260 yards up the fairway with, you know, dialed back equipment. He can play that golf course in much quicker time than he would be playing a golf course having to walk 7,500, 8,000 yards.
Is it likely in any way? Is there
much
talk from your ear to the ground in the golfing world? No,
I would say absolutely no chance whatsoever. The manufacturers have a stranglehold out there, and there's no way they're going to let something like this happen. But it's up to the RNA and the USGA to do it, and move away from, you know, the tail wagging the dog rather than the dog wagging the tail. And
when was the best era for you to watch golf? With equipment at its perfect blend,
going back to Seve and Faldo and Ballesteros, and they were my times to watch golf.
80s, 90s.
Yeah.
So you think watching golf in the 80s, 90s? Okay, the TV coverage was crap by comparison, but in terms of the shots, is that better, or is this rose-tinted glasses?
No, because I'll even go to why I started on tour in 2003, and I was able to, you know, I had a decent career, but. Come the end of it, I was done, because the golf courses were too long, and they'd changed so much. You used to be able to get around and play around different golf courses and shape the ball and get the ball to run out and stuff like that. That's all changed.
Mm.
It's all changed dramatically in the last 5, 6, 7 years.
Okay.
Can I throw a little fly in the ointment, though? And as I absolutely take Peter's point on board, and it's offensive to the golf purists. And I'm unfortunately old enough to remember golf in the 80s and 90s and shape, you know, shot makers and all the rest of it. But to the authorities, is that really a priority given, will it make a difference to overall, the things that really matter, the metrics that matter, audiences, TV, et cetera, et cetera? I'm asking this as an open question. Yeah.
Something has to change because audiences are dwindling dramatically. If you were to ask Sky Sports how is golf at this moment in time, I guarantee you they've lost 20 to 30% viewers.
They have.
Over the last while. And America is the same.
But my point, my question is this. Is this not part of a broader issue that, one, golf is just not as attractive to the mainstay of sports fans for a variety of reasons that have really very little to do with whether bombers dominate or, you know, guys with laid off swings. That this is, it's very hard to compete when you have NBA, when you have football, when you have...
No, I agree with you. I think if they went back to the equipment of the 80s, 90s, whatever we would agree on, I don't think it would change the popularity of golf at all.
Yeah, neither do
but
I.
I think those of us who love the game would enjoy watching it a whole lot more.
But I think it would have a strong effect in the amount of time it takes to play around the golf. Because take for yourself, for example, right? Newly married, possible children on the way, whatever it may be.
What?
Your timing, your time is being reduced dramatically.
Did Kiwi asked you to tell what's going on here?
You
know what I'm saying. You know, your time.
Peter,
to go,
I'm playing twice this week.
Yeah, well, look, there you go.
No, but okay, I take your point. But by the same token, you know, we get on to slow play. We made this point last week. Yeah, okay, we speed it up by 20 minutes. Still takes a lot of time. It's still a long game to play, you know? I mean, like, if I can get around a golf in a three ball in, let's say we get it into 3 hours and 20 minutes, 3.5 hours. That really doesn't change what I have to do with 3 hours and 50 minutes. Do you know what I mean? Like, in terms of making that more doable.
But 3.5 hours is a whole lot better than five.
Oh, but I mean, who plays a 5-hour round? In the amateur ranks.
I've played many 6-hour rounds.
Well, that's different. Let's talk about slow play then. European Tour have led the way. They're saying this has nothing to do with the Bryson DeChambeau thing. It's a hell of a coincidence. I'll say that much for it anyway. So basically, new rules. Starting from late November, a player on the European Tour will incur a one-shot penalty for 2 bad times in a single round. And then there are also going to be fines for those consistently needing to be timed, i.e. being on the clock. Basically, a player who is timed 15 times next season will get a fine of 26,000 sterling, compared with 9,000 sterling now. Interestingly, the tour will reduce field sizes where possible as well, which is kind of interesting. Basically, the old rules, by the way, currently a player would be monitored if he breached the time allowance, which is 50 seconds for first to play, 40 seconds for second or third to play. He then would be officially timed. He would then have to breach twice more before being given a one-shot penalty. So it was tough enough to get fined or incur a one-shot penalty, certainly in the past. Rory McIlroy on the smaller field sizes. It's like traffic, right? You get 156 in the field. It's hard to get those guys around quickly. Even last week, 70. There was no mention of pace of play. I'm in a privileged position. I can say that because I'm going to get into the field of 30 or 70. Obviously, guys that are not quite in my position would disagree with that. But if you want to speed up play, cut the field sizes. I'm sure he'll have lots of people in the locker room saying, thanks, buddy. Appreciate that. It's just my livelihood.
Yeah, cutting the field sizes cuts the opportunity to play. And the big issue the European Tour has, and I think in America as well, is it's the secondary tours and the third tours that are feeding into the European Tour. It's the kids that are coming up who are so used to playing college golf and in Europe, the Challenge Tour and even the Alps Tour and whatever else are ridiculously slow. And they don't have enough referees in these tours to teach the young lads and girls to hurry up. Mm. And this is the big, and then they come out on tour and all of a sudden they go, well, I can't play any quicker. I don't know how to play any quicker.
Interesting. You know? Didn't realise that. So look, this is good. Well, let's not overly dwell on this again because I think this is the most boring topic in golf by far. But were you a quick player?
Yes.
And when you were in a group with 2 slow players?
I slowed down.
You adjusted? It's the only way.
I actually slowed down on purpose.
To get on the clock?
To make sure that those other two were timed. Because I knew I wasn't slow. Okay. I was ready to play all the time.
Right.
But I'd walk slower to the ball and stuff like that. I wouldn't rush. And I would tell an awful lot of the young lads who'd come to me for, I was playing great, but we got timed and then it put me off. I said, well, if you're a fast player, you shouldn't worry about getting timed.
Could you not be stung as part of a group being timed?
No.
Why not?
No, because they did individuals.
Okay.
So your group might be on the clock. Mm. But you mightn't be timed yourself. It might be
You're in a group, you're 6 holes in, you're putting the clock. Mm. It's not you, clearly, and it's your 2 friends, or maybe it's just one of the 3 of you, which is slowing everyone down. What's the etiquette? Do you turn around to the worst offender or even both offenders and say, lads, we're on the clock here, can we get moving a bit? Or is that a no-go?
No, I would always say that, look, you do realise we're on the clock here, lads.
And how would that be received? Go away from me.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah. Sometimes they would say, oh yeah, I know, or whatever, I'm trying my best, or whatever. And you know clearly that once the referee goes off into the woods and goes to the next group, that person just slows down again.
And do others say, Peter, get out of my face, I'm trying to win here?
No. I remember saying that to a referee once in a Spanish Open.
Which you won?
I finished second in the end. It was in San Roque. And Pascal had come over to me, his French referee, and I said, Pascal, will you ever into the bushes there? I said, I'm trying to win a golf tournament.
Yeah.
And of course, he turned around his buggy and went off. But he knew I wasn't slow. It was just that we were a little bit.
Say you're in a fast group.
Yeah.
Are you not just waiting at every tee box?
You are, yes.
So what's the point?
Because you're so used to playing at a certain speed.
Would you play better at your speed?
I would always play better at a nice pace.
Would you play worse at a slow speed or be able to?
It takes more time out of you and you get tired out very quickly because there's an awful lot of hanging around.
What's the most common offence? Because Koepka talked about how your man, name got out of my head, but didn't have his glove on, you know?
Yes. Not being ready. That's the biggest one, yeah.
As opposed to my Jason Day closing my eyes business, it's more the actually not being ready.
It's not being ready. It's not, when your opponent is hitting, you should be looking at your yardage chart. You should be thinking, right, what am I going to hit here? Mm. But the caddy has a lot to do with it as well, because the caddy can get, you know, not be ready either to give you the advice that you're looking for. Mm-hmm. And they're waiting for that person to hit before they get the yardage that all should be done. Just some caddies are not as good as they should be.
Right, okay. And do some players, because I could imagine this, it's hard to concentrate for a long period of time. Some players might not want to go into their routine until it's their turn. So say you're hitting your shot across the fairway, I might want to just like decompress for a minute, relax, you know, and not think about it.
No, you're decompressing between shots.
So you're not buying that?
No.
Peter, that's my excuse. That's
I know.
I've got my routine. I got to wait for you to hit and then I start my routine.
No, these routines need to be snappy.
Okay.
They don't need to be, oh, it's my turn. Okay, let's go into my routine. Let's put on my glove. Let's look at the yardage book. Let's, where's the wind coming from? Okay, it might be a 7, might be a 6. What do you think, caddy?
Yeah.
I'm thinking 6. Well, I'm thinking 7.
What percentage of guys are taking the absolute piss?
The slow ones.
What percentage, though?
Like how many of, say, a
standard 150-odd man field.
Okay, there's probably at least 10 slow players that they have on their radar every week.
That's not too bad.
Out of 150.
That would strike me as not too bad. That's not chronic.
Okay, but what's 15%?
Yeah.
Right? So 15% of the guys who know how to play the game of slow play. So when the referee comes up, they play quickly. And when the referee goes, they go back to slowness.
Okay.
And that's your majority of 15 guys.
Okay.
And that's the issue. And this is why they're bringing in these rules here. Mm. But it's hard to believe that John Paramore fined the Chinese lad, didn't he, in the Masters?
Yeah.
How many years ago is that?
I think it was 2014, was it, Fiona? It's gone back there.
Around there,
So what's that, 5 years ago that he gave out a shot penalty? Mm. And they're only bringing this in now. So they've sort of sat on their hands for quite some time.
Mm. Any other slow play questions, Fionn, you want to fire about what it's like?
No, I have to say, I found all of that very, very interesting. Peter's perspective on it. Very interesting. I mean, ultimately, we talked about this, I know, last week. But it's a bit like I'm watching the Ashes. And it reminds me that, look, cricket can figure out a million different things. T20, one days, limited overs. But like, you know, test cricket is test cricket. Golf is golf. Golf is a slow game. I mean, and this is absolutely taking into account every single thing that Peter says. Even Peter playing relatively quickly is still playing a slow game.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
So golf is by definition a slow game. They are never, ever going to make it like quick. It's never going to be snappy. But how do you then stop it from becoming ridiculous? And, you know, but I have to say, I thought that was a very interesting perspective.
I would rather, by the way, be in the hole and taking a little bit of extra time over, say, my second shot into a green, or an extra little bit of time over my putt or my chip on. I would much rather that, be in the hole, be actually playing the game slowly, but playing the game, rather than zipping through my hole and standing on a tee box. That strikes me as just counter everything.
Right.
Yes.
I don't know how you would take that over. Really, I'm going to take my time over this, but I'm going to really look at it and concentrate and really have a nice rhythm.
Tell me how does that change your shot?
Taking the extra time?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I mean, you get to really get sure that, say a putt. I mean, there's different shots, obviously. But say it's a second shot in, or say it's a putt. Second shot in, you really get to think about your club, have a good chat with the caddy. Certainty. It gives you certainty. So whether it's the line of a putt, you stand over the putt with that touch more confidence, I've got the line here, or the pace equally with the second shot in. How are we feeling about the wind? Yeah, talk it through.
But is that going to change the outcome?
I don't think it hurts me. And I think it's far better than me standing on a tee box thinking about this tee shot for, oh my God, they're still on the fairway. I've been here for 4 minutes.
Yeah, but
water down the left.
There's rubbish on the right.
You're controlling your own pace is the point.
Yeah.
On the tee box, you're not controlling your own pace. Whereas if you play the hole and you're like, well, I'm going to take my time here, you control the pace. You control when you pull the trigger. You get to a point mentally where you're ready to go, as opposed to tee box where it's like just kind of aimlessly waiting for the lads ahead and going nuts on the tee box.
I have to say, I 100% agree with you, Joe, insofar as
100%,
that,
Peter,
in my experience, limited and at my very average level of golf that it is, once, if I'm playing well, I have a biorhythm, and that biorhythm is maintained through, and I'm a fairly quick player as well. Like I don't dilly dally, but if I'm, and I'm thinking particularly about certain competitions where I played, where maybe on the turn, sitting on the 10th tee box, there might be a little backlog because there's a little food hut at the end of the ninth. So you might get like groups, they'll stop and get a cup of soup or whatever. But so you're standing on the 10th and all of a sudden my biorhythm is just gone. And all of a sudden that swing is just not the same it was on the 9th, the 7th, and so on. I find that is the most disruptive element of my golf, is that long wait on the tee box, rather than, say, taking my time over my second shot or maybe looking at the putt from both sides.
Mm. Not for you.
No, look, I can see this happening. You can see it happening in club golfers the whole time. And I'm just trying to think, as Fiona's talking there, is, you know, how do we help the club golfers that are out there that are struggling with this? You know, like you say.
We're grand.
You're grand.
We're grand.
Absolutely.
Fiona can blame that crap shot on 10.
I think
the
you're allergic to getting information from me. Do you know that?
You can blame our crap shots on anything all we want. Nothing to do with any of that. It's funny how the low handicap golfers seem to cope, Fiona.
It's absolutely the case. You are absolutely right.
And I just got out of my rhythm.
Peter, you could stand on the tee box for 11 minutes and there's a 95% chance you're going to hit a pretty sweet drive.
Yeah.
It's not the same for me. It just isn't.
No, that bacon sandwich just probably went down the wrong way,
Exactly. Anyway.
Anyways, right, we'll see if anyone gets fined or loses a shot. That'll be kind of a bit of fun, a bit of jeopardy. It won't be happening on a Sunday down the back nine, I can tell you that much, Peter.
But it won't happen in America, that's for sure. Not for quite some time.
Okay. Right, very lastly, Brooks Koepka's on the ESPN body issue. This is the one he lost 24 pounds for. I thought he'd be more ripped, I have to say. Disappointed.
Yeah, he lost this to be kind of lean and mean and naked. And, but I mean, you know, tastefully naked on the ESPN issue. Mm-hmm. I think the big issue is that he lost all this weight leading up to last year's or this year's Players' Championship. And it really affected his game. So it's like Brooks, he kind of picked and said, I don't care about the players that much.
No, it's hilarious. He's like, I just don't even care. But Phil Mickelson is the one. So we've all seen the Mickelson picture. If you haven't, look at it. Like, it's genuinely shocking. He is now ripped.
I was shocked.
But he's lean. Is he ripped or is he just lean? Very, very lean.
I mean, the angle looks like he's ripped, all right.
Have you seen the photo, Fionn?
He's
not like soft skinny. Like there's a bit of definition.
28 waist.
Oh. Because remember, he rocked up at a tournament a while back and he hadn't eaten for 6 days. He had done this fast.
That was the Open.
Mm. Yes. Okay. So he's obviously got a taste for it. No pun intended. And kept going with the not eating very much. And now here he is, like a man of his age. It's hard to get that ripped when you get to an age and you've put on a certain amount of weight. What's he eating?
I'd like to know. I need to give it a try.
Bloody hell. Come here, so weight changes. This is always one of the great things in golf. Beware the big man who loses a lot of weight.
Yeah, it's a dramatic effect on them.
Is this true? Yeah?
Yeah. I give you a couple of examples. Darren Clark, probably one of the biggest examples.
When was this? Because he's had a few up and downers.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
When he
loses weight, he plays rubbish.
Right.
Puts it back on, plays well.
Right.
Loses weight, puts it back on.
What's your theory on this? Is it because his formative years were overweight and he's got that ingrained?
Just an ingrained swing. You know, you get your swing to a certain place and you start putting on weight. You start losing weight and then all of a sudden your flexibility gets a little bit better.
Okay.
You have less to turn. And your swing gets into a all over the shop, really.
I find it surprising that, like, I don't know, an hour on the driving range wouldn't fix it.
It doesn't. That's the thing. you need to actually put a pack on to get your swing back into a certain place.
Any other examples?
Mickelson, I would have said. Very much so.
Can I add Brooks Koepka here?
Yeah.
Like, he went from ahead of the players. Before the weight loss, he was ninth in strokes gained off the tee. At the Players, he was 46th.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's pretty dramatic.
He lost yardage for sure. Did he start hitting errant drives. Like, I get the loss of power, but I mean, being able to find a fairway, was he spraying it? I can't remember. I think he lost yardage anyway.
He played poorly.
He played very poorly.
Jason Duffner.
Did that coincide with the weight, yeah?
Yeah, very much so.
Right.
Played rubbish after he lost a lot of weight.
Okay.
I mean, with Mickelson, you wonder, I mean, what is he? Is he 47, 48?
I think so, yeah.
48 or 49?
48, maybe 49.
Okay, so here's the thing. I'm 51. And I will say from
experience... Are you about to take off your top here? Where's this going?
Here we go. No, you know, I always had a very fast metabolism. So, but that slowed down over the years. It's natural for our natural metabolism to slow down as we get older. So losing weight past a certain age becomes quite an effort. Mm. And it's really, really difficult. For Mickelson, so you wonder, is it a health-related issue? And, you know, did the doctor say, you know, because he'd put on a few pounds, and certainly last year he was probably bigger than we've ever seen him.
Yeah.
So did the doctor go, look, you know, I mean, you're at risk, et cetera, et cetera. Or is it some kind of weird vanity thing, you know? And if it's the latter, and again, and I'm entirely speculating because I have absolutely no idea, then I would be worried. Like, you know, you're looking at that photograph and sure, he looks ripped. But like, Phil Mickelson has always been, in the parlance, a big boned lad. Like, you know, he's always been, you know, a big fella. And to be 48, 49 and the smallest or slimmest you've ever been isn't necessarily a good thing.
Okay. I thought he looked strong, I have to say.
I would look it on the vanity side of it, I'd have to admit.
This pod holds no punches, does it?
No.
Brutal. Oh,
I'm actually holding back. I wanted to say a few other things, but libel laws and all the rest.
Yeah, it's been a steep learning curve for you and the libel laws over the last couple of months, I would say.
Yeah.
A lot of times I've turned to you and said, Peter, I'm going to have to take that part out afterwards.
Yeah, stop. Stop. Not allowed to say that.
Okay, I think it looks good on him. Looks good.
No.
If it's vanity, it's vanity. No harm.
Yeah, and he does look good. I mean, absolutely. Like, you know, it's his sister took that photograph.
Yes. It was a family
and day. He looks amazing. He looks amazing. But my point again, and again, this is absolute speculation, is it's like that dramatic weight loss past a certain age becomes a supreme effort.
Mm.
And that mightn't necessarily be good for you.
Mm.
And that's the point I'm trying to make. And so, and also as well, is that we all know, like, you know, if you're losing, say, 15 pounds in a week, most of that is water weight anyway. So, like, so you're keeping it off, maintaining a kind of a nice, steady look. That's the real challenge. But it's kind of freaky, I think. Anyway.
I just couldn't believe it.
Or maybe I'm just jealous.
Yeah, maybe you are jealous.
Really, I got to give it a try.
Maybe you're both jealous.
Maybe we should give it a try.
Absolutely. Maybe I'm just really envious.
So let's wrap this up then. Is Justin Thomas with his 2-shot lead over Cantley and the rest going to see this one out, or will the weird pressure, because Justin Thomas described it as weird, Peter, will that weird pressure of having the lead get to him somehow affect his play? What do you think? Who's going to come out on top here? Who's going to win the prestigious $15 million?
I think, look, he has a great chance. He's in the right position. I don't think he's going to find it weird. I think he'll find a little bit of pressure on Sunday, all right,
yeah,
when he realises that he's playing for $15 million. He doesn't get to $15 million up front, does he? It's over a certain period of time.
You can choose, actually.
Can you?
Yeah.
I thought it goes into his pension fund. I know if I'd played America Tour, I wouldn't be here right now. I'd have loads of money in the bank.
Instead, Peter, you're at the Great Spawell driving range.
Absolutely.
Just off the M50.
Yeah.
I was there the other week. It was jammers. 11 a.m. in the morning. I thought I wasn't going to get a bay for a second.
Yeah, I told you there was an upstairs.
Well, there is, yeah.
But you forgot about that.
So, by the way, Brooks Koepka is going to win because he's going to care about $15 million. That's the one.
Okay.
I think Cantlay's going to win.
He's on 8-under, yeah. Okay.
I think Cantlay because I looked at, you see the stat? There are only two players who have better than 2 strokes gained per round this season. Patrick Cantlay, Rory McIlroy.
Interesting.
So he won Memorial. Cantlay's terrific. Like, yeah, I looked at the odds. He's 9-2.
Okay.
You know. He's my guy, I think. Cantley.
Fiona, I want a full review of Spawell from yourself at some stage, you know, one of those good reviews that you give.
I'll come out. I haven't been.
That's what I mean.
No, I will. I promise you I will.
Okay. Very nice, Fiona. Very nice. Good maths, which is always key, I find.
That's always nice.
Don't forget, if you are looking at coming on the Off The Ball Open in Abu Dhabi, the place to get all the information is offtheball.com/open. There are still a few early bird options available. So that's going to be 17th to the 23rd of November in Abu Dhabi. There'll be a Peter Lorre Golf Clinic, which we won't make mandatory because...
I just think it's mandatory to watch Joe hit his first tee shot. So it's worth the money just to come to watch that.
I don't know if I can make it. I may have TV commitments.
I have to say...
there's also a gala awards show. There's an Off The Ball road show. Connor Sketches is going to be there.
Great.
Kieran Donaghy, Kevin Kilbane. All the Off The
Ball wait for it.
Fionn's going to be there, obviously. I should have led with that, really.
Absolutely.
Yaz Links. Abu Dhabi.
Yaz Links. Seriously, lads. Yaz Links. Amazing.
It's the way forward, isn't it?
I've
played both of them, yeah.
Is Yaz good, yeah?
Very good, yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're hearing. That is us done for this week. I'm sure we'll be back next week. We may not be. There's like a 17-hour extravaganza here and Off The Ball. We're taking over. We're doing 17 hours of straight broadcasting in build-up to the All-Ireland Football Final. So we may struggle next week. We'll try and sort something out. We do have an Adair Manor review recorded, which we're going to put up as well at some stage.
Yes.
That might come your way.
This is the one I wasn't invited to, is it?
Yeah.
I did say it to you.
Yeah, you did. That you're not invited. I just wanted to get that one in there, Joe.
Bloody hell. Getting jabbed from all sides here. Right, that is us done. Peter, thank you.
Thank you.
Say hello to everyone at Spawell. And Fionn, thank you.
See you, lads.
Bye bye.
Weekly from Off The Ball. Brought to you by the Off The Ball Open in Abu Dhabi this November. Book your place now at offtheball.com/open.